The 100 Years' War, the Second Intermediate Period, 1345-1356. France convinces the Scots to stay in the battle against England, and Edward III plans to invade France. The King of France and his ministers followed Edward III's long-drawn dealings with the Scots as best they could. But although they were quite well informed about events in London and in southeastern England, the French had very little intelligence about anything that happened in the north. Their best source of information was probably a small Scottish merchant community at Bruges, which was the main entrepont for the trade of the east coast ports of Scotland. The news of the conferences of Hexham and Newcastle did not reach Paris until after they had ended. Too late, John II addressed a florid plea to the prelates, barons, magnates, and nobility of the community of the realm of Scotland, urging them to stand by the alliance with France and to fight the common enemy. The messengers who carried these letters to Scotland added their own exhortation, but there is no evidence that they had any impact. The most that King John could promise by way of help was a comfortable exile in France for those who were defeated. On August 8, 1352, at the height of the French campaigns in Brittany and the Garonne Valley, John wrote another letter to the Scots imploring them to reject the proposed treaty with England, 6 months after they had done so for their own reasons. He had great confidence, he said, in their loyalty to the French alliance and their constancy in the face of adversity. The truth was that John had nothing to offer the Scots. After the truth of Guinness in March of 1353, they had raised short-lived hopes of peace at the French court. The French king wrote to William Laudels, whom he had probably known during the exile of the Scottish king in Normandy in the 1330s. He declared that Scotland held a special place in his affections, and that his mind dwelt as much on the well-being of its inhabitants as on that of his own people. He assured Laudels that the proper provision would be made for the security of Scotland in any treaty of peace. He sent agents to other Scots magnates with the same message. When a year later, John's ambassadors made another truce with the English at Guinness, Scotland was included in it, and the king wrote asking them to observe it. But in the secret treaty, which was made at the same time, the Scots were actually not mentioned. The Scots cannot have known the details of the secret treaty of Guinness, but they drew the right conclusions from what had happened. In July of 1354, after several months of intermittent negotiations, they finally agreed to ransom their king. The sum promised was 90,000 marks. It was agreed that although the ransom was payable by installments over a period of 9 years, David II should be released at once on parole in exchange for the heirs of 20 of the most prominent magnates of Scotland. The Scottish ambassador agreed no alteration in the status of the crown, and they made final peace. But they knew that by the laws of war, David could not wage war in England while he was Edward III's prisoner on parole. The treaty provided that a truce would be declared, which was to last until the final installment of the ransom had been paid. If it had been implemented, it would have marked a practical withdrawal of Scotland from the French alliance. The French were well aware of this. It was their intervention which wrecked the treaty. It was August 1354, a month after the conference, Newcastle, that John II's council turned decisively against the Treaty of Guinness. Although the Scots duly ratified the ransom agreement in early October, difficulties and delays began almost immediately afterwards. At the outset, these may have been attributable to the real problems of raising the first installment of the ransom in an impoverished country gravely damaged by war. By the end of the year, it was evident that the French had persuaded the Scots to repudiate their agreement with Edward III and reopen the war. In order to do this, it was necessary to promise them armed assistance, and almost certainly money. The circumstances are shrouded with obscurity. On the 5th and the 11th of January, 355, there were two meetings of the French Royal Council in Paris, attended by Jean de Crancier and the Chamberlain of the Dauphin's household, one of the few Frenchmen with first-hand experience with affairs of Scotland. 20 years before, in the winter of 1335 and 36, he had taken a small contingent of French troops to Aberdeen, the advance guard of a great French army that never came. John II now appointed him as lieutenant in Scotland and put him in command of a small expeditionary force. By February 1355, when the first installment of David's ransom was due to be paid, it had become clear in England that the treaty was a dead letter. Large raiding parties were reported to be gathering in the lowlands. At the end of the month, all the northern counties of England were placed on war footing. David II was removed from the keep at Newcastle, where he was waiting for his release, and brought south. He was taken to Oldham, a grim 13th century fortress, by the main road from London to Winchester, which belonged to the Queen Philippa. She had planted an enclosed garden there with ornamental hedges and covered seats, a large lace cuff on the mailed fist. The Scottish king was received there on March 7, 1355. Jan Garan says, had been given his final orders in the letters of appointment at St. Denis 2 days earlier. On March 16, he left with his company of 60 men, including 2 native Scots, all elite knights with famous and valiant squires. Well, while this is going on, Edward is preparing to restart the war on the continent. Now, the Duke of Lancaster arrived back in England on March 28, 1355. And he traveled as fast through France as he could. He was followed within 2 days by emissaries of Pope Innocent VI, who were sent after him to limit the damage done in the acrimonious closing days of the Pope's diplomatic conference. The principal of the new legation, Andron de la Roche, was a Benedictine monk from Burgundy who had been abbot of Cluny for the past 4 years. He may have realized the hopelessness of his first mission when he was appointed, but if he did not, his eyes were soon opened. In the middle of April 1355, he appeared with his colleague at a meeting of the Great Council in the Palace of Westminster. He presented a proposal to extend the current truce to allow further negotiations. Unusually, the king answered him in person. The French, he said, had often arranged for papal legations to come before him to propose truces. They invariably repudiated them as soon as it suited them. He was willing to consult his council about the latest proposal, but his own inclination was to reject it. He would return his formal answer in due course. As the legates made their way back down the Dover Road, the council resolved to reopen the war with 2 simultaneous campaigns, one in Normandy and the other in Gascony. So we're finally going to get out of this so-called truce period. And as you see, truce periods or interim agreements still leave lots of room for fighting. And so we're heading very quickly into the Poitiers period. The sources for this: The Hundred Years' War, Volume 2, Trial by Fire by Sumption, Hundred Years' War by Nylands, and The Hundred Years' War by Perrois. So I hope you enjoyed that. And as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out the CDs, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.